Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with filmmaker, writer, and political activist and organizer, Astra Taylor, who's released two books within the past year, The Age of Insecurity, and her latest, co-authored with Leah Hunt Hendricks, Solidarity, The Past, Present, and Future of a World-Changing Idea. And you can learn more. I'm going to give you two websites. Hidden Driver, that's one word, Hidden Driver, H-I-D-D-E-N, just as you thought, HiddenDriver.com, or Debt Collective, Debt Collective, one word, .org. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Terrence McNally, all one word, .net. In this crucial election year, in which democracy itself may be on the ballot, let me encourage you not only to get involved with candidate campaigns that strike a chord with you, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans are able to exercise their right to vote. And if there's anything you can do that can bring people out of the woodwork, I think this is going to be a turnout election. So whether it's young people, seniors, and so on, working people who just are burdened and don't have time to get to the polls, anything you can do to bring the people to the voting booth and help them get their vote counted is going to be necessary. Now to today's guest. When we want to solve problems in society, it seems to me there are three primary paths, and there may be more, but three different approaches that we can choose to take. There's the approach of writing about it, or in my case, talking about it. Perhaps we could include academia in this approach. One does research, maybe, and writes to tell the story and arouse people to action by explaining problems, revealing their history, analyzing causes and consequences, and offering solutions. A second approach is to be an activist, to organize in political and policy arenas, often drawing attention to wrongs, demanding change. I imagine we can loosely include much of the sphere of politics in this approach. And the third is to actually start an organization or work within an organization that is attempting to put into practice and to scale solutions. What I find both fascinating and a bit intimidating about today's guest, Astra Taylor, is that she pursues all three. As I mentioned in my brief intro at the top, she's a filmmaker, a writer, an organizer, and an activist. Not only that, she's very committed to all of them in her day-to-day life, evidenced by the fact that when we were booking this conversation, we had to work around her schedule with the Debt Collective. And as I said, she's released two books in basically the last year or so. As activists, Taylor and Leah Hunt Hendricks, co-founder of Progressive Philanthropy Network's Solidaire and Way to Win, sensed that the concept of solidarity was being taken for granted. In their book, Solidarity, The Past, Present, and Future of a World-Changing Idea, they find it alive and well in schools of fish and flocks of birds, trace its origins back to ancient Rome, and explore its relevance in today's interconnected world. They offer what they term transformative solidarity as a tool that we must cultivate if we hope to sustain democracy. Taylor's 2023 Massey Lectures, a series of talks that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation has aired for the past 60-odd years, were published as The Age of Insecurity. In them, Astra looks at the intersection of the emotional and the economic, of the psychological and the political, and proposes insecurity as a framework for understanding a number of the crises we face. In fact, she says, capitalism is an insecurity-producing machine. Many of the ways we try to make ourselves and our societies more secure, money, property, possessions, police, the military, have paradoxical effects, undermining the very security we seek and accelerating harm done to the economy, the climate, and people's lives, including our own. Astra Taylor was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and raised in Athens, Georgia. Her documentary films include What is Democracy? And Examined Life. She regularly writes for major publications, and her books include Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, Remake the World, Essays, Reflections, Rebellions, the American Book Award winner, The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, The Age of Insecurity, and with Leahan Hendricks, Solidarity. Taylor has also toured with the band Neutral Milk Hotel and co-founded a union of debtors, the Debt Collective. Welcome back, Astra Taylor, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction, and thanks for having me.
Okay, and let me tell people that we are recording this conversation Tuesday, April 9th. One thing I also wanted to mention is, as I think I said to you before we went on the air, Astra, I went back and listened to our 2020 conversation, and I just want to say to listeners, definitely worth a listen. You can find it at all those places where I said my podcast exists. And that 2020 conversation was focused primarily on the documentary, What is Democracy?, and the book, the sort of companion book, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone. And given what has happened in the years just before and since, I think the questions of democracy are, relevant, enlightening, and urgent. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So let me ask you, how do you integrate all the paths and roles that I mentioned? And do you have an overarching vision or mission and sort of strategically plan in that regard? Or do you end up making your choices more intuitively or organically?
It's a great question. I don't know if we really know ourselves, so I'm not sure that whatever answer I'll give is actually correct. But, I think in a way my personal priority in life is to follow my curiosity. Mm. I don't want my curiosity to be constrained. And so a lot of my, my projects, my sort of intellectual output, and I would count my films in that, come from genuine curiosity, genuine questions. The film, What is Democracy?, has a question as the title, because yep. I was genuinely consumed with that inquiry. But I'm someone who is also just very motivated by justice. And I just have been since I was a little kid. One of my first memories is refusing to eat meat because I realized it was animals. And I was very concerned about the environment from a young age. And so my curiosity is very entwined with my social conscience. And so to me, the various forms, writing books, writing essays, making documentaries, whether they're short or long, or helping to build a political organization and think of creative actions, they actually all feel like expressions of the same drive, which is a drive to understand the world and hopefully to make it a bit better than it is. And so the work, it if you look at it, it's all kind of self-referential. Sort of the seed of the next project will be in the project before it. Mm-hmm. There's sort of real threads weaving it together. Lately, I've been thinking that I should just take a wild, wild leap and go become a botanist for a while after this, but who knows?
And you didn't say that flippantly. You're saying that's really something that's been bouncing around in your mind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I just think life is amazing, and there's so much to learn about and so much to understand and so much to care about. And sometimes I think I need to rove a bit further afield, maybe through the actual fields, who knows. But right now, I think this aspect of curiosity is key. And I think it's a political ethos too, right? Because if you're not curious, but you're politically minded, you're going to become someone who's very rigid and dogmatic and probably destructive, I think. And so I think, the curiosity is a temperament, but I increasingly think about it as something that it's really something that we really have to work to cultivate, you know, especially as we become more engaged with the project of trying to bring about, you know, social, political, and economic change.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I was surprised when curiosity was the first word that came out. I would have been less surprised if justice had been the first one. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But as you were speaking, I was reminded of a friend who both has an approach and wrote an essay about dealing with her autistic child. And her basic counsel was, instead of being upset, be curious.
Mm.
And as I say, when that thought came to me as you were speaking, I thought this is true on the most specific, intimate level, and then on the large society level as well.
Yeah, and it's a virtue or character trait we don't really talk about that much. We kind of take it for granted, but it is, to me, you know, what also keeps me going through the slog of organizing. Organizing politically is hard work. I was just actually on a call with the Debt Collective, which is the first union of debtors. And one of our folks there said, you know, organizing is logistics. It's, you know, just kind of trying to get people to act in formation. And, you know, and it can become a grind, right? And so, but the curiosity about, well, other people's lives and how power actually works and what are actually the best levers to create change and how can we creatively dramatize, you know, the human condition. These are interesting questions, and it's that kind of intellectual stimulation that I think, you know, motivates me as much as the idea that I think people should be less exploited, that, you know, mm-hmm. we should create an economy that's less extracted and that we should do better.
Yeah. And the other thing that I thought my friend was implying or even saying in her essay was that how it applies to the larger society, I think, is that when we are upset at injustice, at the other side, all of those sorts of polarizing sorts of things, that curiosity is a really helpful entry point into how to deal with those things, I think. Why do they feel that way? Why does they think that way? Why do they think they can get away with all of those sorts of questions?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with your friend. I'd like to read the essay.
I'll make a note to myself. You also said in something I read, a lot of my ideas these days are generated by my organizing. And I'm guessing there's like a mutual sort of feedback loop.
There really is. You know, people often divide things into theory and practice, right? So you have the grand ideas, there's this kind of intellectual work that's done up in the ivory tower, and then there's the grunt work, there's the practice, there's the doing, you know, you're following the recipe that somebody else has written. And I completely reject that, particularly when we're thinking about social change. I mean, there are a lot of people with really wonderful, elaborate, you know, well-polished theories of how the world works that don't actually map onto reality. It's easy, for example, to come up with a list of policy solutions and fixes. We should do this. We should mm-hmm. do that. Figuring out how to actually convince other people that we should do something together, anything, figuring out how you actually implement policies in an incredibly complicated, fragmented, multifaceted, unpredictable world is a totally different thing. And to me, the sweet spot is to, you know, go out in the world, gather some empirical evidence, have some experiences, think about them, reflect on them, adapt your ideas, go back, try them out and think some more in this, you know, wonderful, curious, but engaged and committed feedback loop. And so, you know, I wrote the book about democracy and made the film about democracy that you mentioned, you know, really partly inspired by my experience at Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, a very anarchist inflected movement. There were no leaders. It refused to make demands. And yet it galvanized all of these folks, right? When we said it was the movement for the 99%, you know, everybody who showed up there was not an anarchist. All sorts of folks came because they felt that there was something deeply wrong with the political system and the financial crisis and all of that. It was out of Occupy, actually, that the seeds of the Debt Collective were planted and
sort
of set me on my path to be an organizer focused on economic justice. But the question of democracy really kind of stuck in my craw from my experience there. And then I wrote a book that really is a book of political philosophy. And I would say that my organizing, as it became more sustained and kind of strategic and disciplined, and I sort of shifted from the movement moment of Occupy to the institution building project of the debt collective, that, you know, I started to think about solidarity as something that is more than just a buzzword. And I started to think about the fact that in all of our meetings and all of our outreach, what we were really trying to do was build solidarity between people. Solidarity is about relationships. It's a relational concept. And then I thought back to my work on democracy, and I thought, oh, that's so interesting. Why in my book did I emphasize freedom and equality so much? You know, but I left out solidarity, right? And in a way, I now see that as so American of me, maybe even North American of me, but certainly American of me, to think, yes, you know, we need freedom, we need equality, but let's not talk about this slightly messier concept, which is about how people actually relate and what holds a group together. The idea in a slightly different form was there in the French Revolution, where they have the tripartite motto, right? Freedom, liberty, and fraternity. Of course, solidarity, I prefer to fraternity because it's not gendered. But what they recognized even back then was, if you want to have a full sort of democratic philosophy and democratic practice, you're actually going to have to think about the relational stuff too. And so solidarity gets us there, which is just a long way of saying that, you know, the theory feeds the practice feeds the theory. And I think that isolating them is counterproductive. And it's certainly sort of against my ethos to think, well, there's smart people who can tell the masses what to do, and they should just sort of take their instructions, but not think. You know, that's not my approach to things at all. That's not my my value.
In listening back to our 2020 conversation, a bunch of questions occurred to me. And so in some sense for me, and I'm sort of inviting you, there's a reflection a little bit on the past 4 years. And one question I did want to ask is that when we spoke in 2020, early in the pandemic, I think it was May, and the pandemic really was kind of declared in March. Yeah. 4 years later, I'm curious about your take on what we learned about ourselves, our relationship to each other, to our government, about trust, community, solidarity. And let me share, as I think I did even did then, it was my hope at the time, again, very early in the pandemic, that our shared vulnerability, that the while it might be more likely that you'd get the virus if you were a first responder or worked in a restaurant, anybody could get it. And in some ways, the virus didn't discriminate, and it leveled the playing field a bit. And it was my hope, as I said, that that shared vulnerability would help us bring us together. And I was surprised and deeply, deeply disappointed that in some ways our response actually pulled us further apart. I don't think I'd considered the possibility that something as huge and devastating as a pandemic could be subsumed into our petty political polarization. Any thoughts about, you know, that whole notion and what was revealed, what was learned from our experience?
Such a great question. I mean, I think it was around that time that I learned that the etymology, the original meaning of the word apocalypse, is to unveil, right? To sort of reveal things. And maybe, and to reveal, in this case, things that we didn't know and maybe didn't want to know. So, you know, your phrase shared vulnerability really speaks to me. I mean, I was right there with you, hoping that this was something that would, you know, almost dramatize other crises, right? That it would almost be a sort of intense experience of the true threat of climate change, right? It would make us think about public health and pandemics in a different way. And there were signs early on that that was a possibility. And, you know, I think in a way that we've been, you know, my two recent books both grapple with this. So The Age of Insecurity is all about how, I use the word vulnerability a lot, but insecurity, you know, is sort of constitutive of the human condition. It can also, there's also a manufactured variant of it, right? Our fears, our anxieties, our vulnerabilities are sort of exploited. And And, you know, and I think what we saw was that engine of manufactured insecurity, of exploiting vulnerabilities, of using it to pit people apart, you know, really revved up in ways that progressives were not prepared for. And, you know, that sort of led, watching that unfold led to an epiphany, I think, that's central to the Solidarity book, which is that solidarity is not spontaneous. It's generated. It has to be cultivated. And, you know, it was, it, you know, in a moment of crisis like that, we have to work really hard, actually, to build the solidarity, I think, around, you know, a solidarity that is based on the recognition of our shared vulnerability that can withstand, you know, all of the forces pushing us in different directions, and can help people, you know, sort of stay grounded and stay together. And so, you know, a big theme of the Solidarity book is precisely that. It's solidarity is something we really have to cultivate. Mm. That is something we have to work to build. And I'll just say that, you know, it's quite interesting to me, looking back at the history of solidarity. I've already mentioned the French Revolution and the idea of liberty, equality, fraternity. But when the concept was really picked up at the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, it was in a period of social tumult. So it's the Industrial Revolution. People are moving from, you know, the countryside to cities, and folks are asking, well, what's going to hold society together, you know, in this period of sort of tumult, you know, in this nascent, this moment of nascent democracy, what's going to hold society together in the absence of God or kings? So there's a big political economic questions, but also there was a burgeoning awareness of infectious disease, right? Things like tuberculosis, cholera, and people were realizing, oh, wow, we actually are connected, even if we're not literally touching each other. And this awareness of public health actually was part of the backdrop of this first wave of thinking about solidarity as a social and political concept. So it's just interesting to me.
Yes. You know,
we what we forget, we're kind of doomed to repeat. And so little did I know that we are kind of in an analogous moment of, again, social tumult, political tumult, and infectious disease. The last thing I'll say that I think we learned, and in it's mentioned in both books as well, is that we have the money, right? There was a massive infusion of spending.
God.
Even with Donald Trump as the president,
right?
We saw a huge expansion of the welfare state. We unfortunately were not well organized enough to fight to keep it, but it was pretty amazing, and it shows that it can happen, and if it happened then, it can happen again. And I think that's something we can't let be erased. You know, we thanks to you know, federal funding, child poverty was slashed in Canada and in the United States by 40%. Kids were literally not going hungry. You know, people were released from some jails. You know, evictions were halted. Student debt payments were paused. So these are things that we can't, again, we can't let that be forgotten, that it happened. It made people's lives better. It, you know, and so we have to fight for that to happen again. And we should also be honest about why we weren't able to sort of build the political leverage to keep those things.
Yeah, no, you're right. I have certainly referenced that notion. Over the ensuing time in some of these conversations, you know, that look what we were, you know, that was in some ways the greatest rapid anti-poverty program that we'd ever seen, and what
yes.
what was impossible in the words of mainstream culture and certainly mainstream politics, it turned out was not. But your point that how we couldn't hold on to that, it seems to me, you know, I don't know I haven't thought about the messaging nuances of it, but it seems that wouldn't be a terrible thing for people to think about right now in an election year, you know, that these things that are being, you know, we're being told that we've got to cut Social Security and we, you know, this sort of thing. And,
absolutely.
And in fact, what did we do 3 years ago? What did we do? And how did we, what did we achieve? And why should we let that go? Just a thought. I wanted to say something about community and solidarity, which is I grew up in the 50s and went to college in the 60s, and really a great deal of my consciousness certainly emerged and was honed in that period. And so I've thought a bit about the 60s as I look at younger people today, whether, you know, so many are younger than I, but whether I'm looking at millennials or Z or X or whatever label you put on it. And I feel like that we made a great deal of progress, significant progress in social and cultural terms, civil rights, women's rights, notwithstanding the overturning of Roe v. Wade, LGBTQ rights, easing of the drug war, etc. The things that we have done a not as good a job on, significantly so, were the things where you can actually follow the money, right? In other words, those were social and cultural, and the money part sort of seems like a bit of a wash, but where it really comes down to the money, inequality is worse than ever. But another value that I feel that we didn't preserve was our sense of community. And I believe we lost it one technological innovation, one demographic trend, one geographic shift at a time. And I don't think we notice the gradual loss, but the price that we paid for convenience and mobility is really high, and presents a huge challenge in a society where our pain, fear, disappointment, and I'll add insecurity seems to fuel tribalism instead. You know, I mean, just some thoughts about.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're saying is really interesting. You know, I feel old compared to the Gen Z folks. In fact, you know, being an activist will really age you fast.
Oh, yes.
Of the 1960s, right? Where, like, if you're 30 year old. So I'm now routinely referred to as a veteran, a movement veteran.
Right.
but, you know, I think absolutely that that's right. There has been tremendous social progress. And I think I'm, on some level, just so fortunate to have been born at the very end of the 1970s and late September 1979 as a woman, right? Just at the sort of to reap the benefits that the second wave of the women's rights movement, you know, granted me and so many others. But, you know, those social movements coincided and not randomly. I mean, they actually sort of helped inspire a really ferocious corporate backlash.
Exactly.
That in a way, you know, people did not have antibodies to. They weren't really prepared for. And, you know, if you look back at the history of American, you know, labor relations and exploitations, I mean, you know, bosses, you know, outlawed labor organizing, you know, in the colonial era. It wasn't until the New Deal that, you know, labor unions were even sort of formally legally allowed with the passage of the Wagner Act. I mean, it's not that it just came out of nowhere, but there's no doubt that, you know, in response to the upheavals of the 1960s and the progress that formerly marginalized populations were making, and the presence of wildcat strikes and actually a kind of re-energized labor movement, that bosses and conservative strategists got together and were like, we're going to really fight this. We're going to invest huge sums of money and resources to push back and capture the state, insulate it from democratic demands, roll back progressive taxation, impinge labor rights, deregulate the financial sector, and all of that. You know, my hope is for movements that can now be like, okay, we need to address both together.
Yes.
Let's get over this idea that it's identity politics or economics, you know, but also, but actually these things are really critical. They're together. And I think they actually speak to your point about community, because, you know, I'm very critical of digital technologies, not necessarily for the technologies, but because of the business interests they're serving, right? Like, these are massive, you know, corporations that are not actually in the business of providing, you know, communications platforms so we can have, you know, free speech and deliberative democracy, right? They're about serving eyeballs to advertisers.
That's right. That's right. No,
let me just remind
people that what something we've said here many times: if the product appears to be free, you are the product.
100%. And so I think that the erosion of community can't be separated from, you know, the deregulation of business, you know, both in the sense that we're now in a sort of media landscape that they control, from the attacks on labor. So now people have to work not just 40 hours a week, mm-hmm. but 60, and both parents have to work. So how can you have community when you literally are never even home? You know, so I think we can't separate the problem of community that you're naming from these troubling economic trends. You know, I think the challenge for us, though, is we won't be able to fix those troubling economic trends if we don't build community.
Right.
Because that's, you know, organizing isn't just strategy. And certainly it's not just, you know, unfortunately, social change won't happen just by voting alone. I think we should vote and do other
Absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely.
And what kind of keeps people in movements or in whether it's labor unions or debtors unions or community groups or tenants unions or their local indivisible chapter or, you know, their, you know, environmental group is that it actually gives them meaning too,
yes.
you know, and connection. And so rebuilding community offline and online or through whatever channels we can do it is actually, I think, a core part of the political puzzle we have to solve.
Yes, yes. Looking hard at where we are breaks down those barriers. In other words, if you really look hard at what's going on, you've got to unite them both. And
yes.
one thing that occurred to me as you were speaking, Astra, was that I'm pretty damn certain that unlike the folks in the early 70s, Lewis Powell, Milton Friedman, Reagan, Buckley, you know, those folks who were sort of creating this backlash, this very effective backlash to the 60s. I don't think that the tech companies that have colonized our minds and our neurotransmitters actually had a preference for polarization. I think they would have, you know, pushed whatever drug worked, you know, if
yes.
you get what I'm saying. It just turns out that anger and resentment and grievance
yes.
and jealousy and insecurity are the most financially lucrative to them. It was almost like a byproduct of just wanting our attention.
Yeah, and I think that's the problem with capitalism in its purest form, is that when, you know, profits are the god you worship and you amass those profits by selling nasty stuff, you sell nasty stuff. I mean, that's it, right? But I think you're right. If it had turned out that, wow, we can make just as much money with awe.
Right, awe and laughter.
And obviously, yeah. And cute animal videos
right.
are, you know, a big part of what keeps a certain portion of the world on the internet, but it certainly isn't the main driver. And the fact is, you know, a lot of the clients for these social media companies, you know, are actively pursuing an agenda of fear-mongering, mm-hmm. hatred, and division, and that's, you know, and Mark Zuckerberg got up there, I think it was in 2019 when he was held before Congress and said, yeah, you know, if people lie in their political ads, you know, I'll still let them do it because, you know, again, it's about the money. So these platforms are really, you know, worrying in so many ways. They're also, you know, This gets to the question, I guess, maybe of curiosity again to me, you know, and thinking in terms of the debt collective, the challenge is, okay, so how do we use them to the mm-hmm. best of our ability and to our advantage, you know, to reach people, to bring them into a different kind of community, to use them as tools for political education, to speak to the fact that people are angry and often, you know, rightly so. And how can we turn that anger into indignation and ultimately solidarity? And so sometimes I talk about organizing as alchemy, you know, organizing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Organizing
no, it
as logistics.
Makes very good sense. Yes.
Yeah, but it's also a kind of magic.
Yeah. But because there are others looking at looking from the opposite perspective at the same thing. How do I translate that feeling of being let down, that feeling of disappointment into something, you know, worse, you know,
yes.
but the alchemy of transforming the feeling of insecurity, the feeling of aloneness, of loneliness, of all these things into something that can transform. These are among the deeper questions and challenges upstream of economic equality, decent working conditions and all of that sort of thing. Let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with filmmaker, writer, political organizer, Astra Taylor. She's released a couple of books within the past year or so. One is The Age of Insecurity, and her latest, co-authored with Leah Hunt Hendricks, Solidarity, The Past, Present, and the Future of a World-Changing Idea. And as you're listening to this conversation, you can see how both of these books arose from, you know, from the organizing and then contribute sort of to the pathway of even better organizing. And you can learn more about Astra's work at hiddendriver.com. That's one word, hidden, H-I-D-D-E-N, hiddendriver.com. And also at debtcollective.org, which is the website of her organization of the Debt Collective, which is a union of debtors. Truly, Astra, as I was preparing this one, I went, my God, you know, I could spend a full hour on solidarity, a full hour in security, and then there are all these other ideas, since you're into a lot of things, and so am I. So one thing we talked about last time, which I think is worth people knowing about, especially since you shared about your youthful curiosity being sort of a driver of much of the rest of your life, is the fact that you had a fairly unique childhood. Certainly among folks that I talked to in this program, you were homeschooled or even unschooled. And the homeschooling movement has only grown in the 4 years since we last spoke. Not only that, but the pandemic and the closing of schools for varying amounts of time around the country seems to have contributed to an enormous drop in school attendance and a rise in what we quaintly, I think, term truancy. But as someone who's looked at things from, you know, different perspectives than most of us, what do you think is going on? And does this concern you? And do you have any ideas where this leads or how we reverse this trend?
It's a big question, and it relates to an essay I'm actually working on at the moment about the attacks from the far right on education as a public good, from the K through 12 level to higher education. And, you know, I'll also say that I was unschooled, which is a radical, almost anarchist version of homeschooling. So imagine homeschooling, but without any pretense that you're doing school. So no homework, no tests, no curriculum, no bedtimes, no alarm bells, none of that. No teachers, no books, no dirty looks. Just the romantic idea that we're all inherently curious learning beings, and what we should do is tap into that curiosity. So that was my background until I was 13, and I actually chose to go to public school, and then I did go to college. But you know, much of my organizing at the Debt Collective is focused on the provision of public goods, so the cancellation of debts that people incur for things like education, healthcare, and housing, and then the provision of education, healthcare, and housing as a matter of democratic. Right. So, you know, I've always kind of occupied this tension where, you know, I had a very unusual anarchist, almost libertarian kind of upbringing that was skeptical of schools as not so much. So a Christian homeschooler will say, you know, I don't want my kids to go to school because it's about indoctrination and I want to shelter them from the corrupted world. I was unschooled by more 60s counterculture folks, right? My mom was actually born in 1960. She had gone to this amazing free school in the Yukon Territory. So it was a spirit of the counterculture. So we stayed home. We didn't go to school because we didn't want to be cloistered away from the world. So we would say the world is our classroom, right? So it was totally different than a Christian homeschooling approach, in that it was the opposite of trying to protect. It was about actually trying to expose and kind of have this radical openness, all very lovely sounding. And you know, now, as you know, I'm a political theory nerd. So this resonates, for example, with the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote his famous book, Emile, you know, who kind of had this idea that, you know, children are inherently good. Just, you know, don't taint them with your social structures and the inherent goodness of people will emerge. Well, obviously, I am conflicted about that. I think that we're social beings. And part of why unschooling works so well for me is that I grew up in a really rich, and I mean rich in the sense of intellectually rich, culturally rich. I sometimes describe it as a kind of nutrient-rich broth, where there are books and instruments and encouragement and this amazing faith in my capacity to just be a decent person. And that this idea that came from my parents that my opinions and preferences mattered. And so this incredible trust. But not every kid has that in this very unequal world. And also, I think that to have a society, we have to have sort of things in common. We have to have shared experiences. You know, we have to have some shared knowledge to a degree. And I again, really believe in public goods. And so I, you know, am really troubled by the far right war on education, which I see as ultimately as a war, part of their war on democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, I see them using these post-COVID trends that you're talking about, people homeschooling, as wedge issues to try to impose universal vouchers. So this is happening, for example, in North Carolina, where, you know, people can now get paid to send their kids to private schools, to Christian schools, to homeschool. And it's really a way of just further attacking public schools and teachers' unions.
And attacking in the sense that it weakens it. It
weakens them. It literally takes their budgets away.
Yeah, like the insurance industry.
Yes.
The more people in the pool, the better it should be able to work. And when you start pulling people out, you break that down.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, I'm, you know, my ideal model is, you know, if we dream, right?
Yes.
Then what I wanted as a kid was, you know, a place to go where I could both rigorously learn and play, right? Like I was, you know, to me, it just seemed really wild that I had to stay at school for 9 hours a day and that so much of it was just busy work and was demeaning. And that, you know, I mean, because I did try school. I tried fourth grade when I was 8 years old, and actually stayed the year. And I was like, why do I have to ask to go to the bathroom? I know if I need to go to the bathroom. Yeah. This is just, you know, insulting. And so you know, I think we could extend a lot more trust to kids. And in fact, that's what a lot of rich people do, right? They send their kids to these beautiful, you know, respectful, creativity encouraging, you know, islands of privilege. And what I just want is a system where that is possible for everybody, which is why, you know, I, and I'm not alone in this, at the Debt Collective, we talk about free education that's free as in price and aimed at liberation, that we actually all have a right to be curious, to learn, to explore fields that might not just lead to immediate employability in a career. And that what we need to do is take the education structures that we have and just, you know, invest in them and create egalitarian social conditions so that all kids have a chance to flourish in them rather than further erode them. So I think there are lessons from my unique educational background, and it's certainly an experience I'm really grateful for, but I do not see homeschooling or unschooling as a panacea, far from it. But I see this trust in people's capacities, the idea that we're all learning, curious beings, the idea that there's a famous or a well-known kind of figure in the unschooling movement who I have some issues with, but he said something I really like. He said, genius is as common as dirt. And actually, if we acted like that was the case, that would just be such a profound challenge to our, you know, our culture of fake meritocracy.
Oh, right.
You know, where rich folks are, you know, enriching their kids, like their sacks of flour to get them on the fast track to the Ivy League. And then what if we're just like, you know what? There's all kinds of people in the world. There's a lot of genius here. Yeah. Let's actually try to spread the encouragement and the resources around. So a long way of saying that it's something that I think a lot about. And, you know, I'm, I, um, you know, I still wrestle with to this day.
I want to make a point and then reinforce one part of the question. And the point was that as we spoke of when we spoke in 2020, I come from an experience where I did not have unschooling or homeschooling. I was a I went to Catholic school for the first 10 years and public school the last two. But I had John Holt as my tutor and founded a school that operated on these principles. I had taught previously in a more regular school. And when I had the chance through his mentorship and some kids who were feeling they were getting the raw end of the deal at a new private school to start my own, this is the kind of school we created, one that was embedded in the real world and gave kids a great deal of freedom. I want to talk just a little bit more about trust. You mentioned it in terms of trusting children and so on. And I'm not sure exactly what my question is, but I assume that trust, I remember I was saying upstream things. I think trust is upstream of almost everything. I think it's essential, perhaps a prerequisite for any successful relationship, whether that's between you and your intimate partner or between you and your children or parents or between each of us and our communities, certainly between us and our government. Where do you see trust most threatened? And do you see pathways to rebuilding it?
Trust is so key. I agree. I think actually that, you know, trust is baked into the idea of democracy. Democracy is the idea that the people, the demos, rule, kratos, that we rule together. That doesn't work if you don't trust other people, right? That doesn't work if you have this fundamental distrust in your fellow citizens. And that's why trust is so corrosive to the democratic project. So I think even to say I live in a democracy, I want to live in a democracy, is to say I aspire to trust other people. So then we have to ask, well, what are the conditions where that becomes more possible, right? This is why we have to be very vigilant against corruption, against misinformation and disinformation, against, you know, power hoarding and self-dealing, all of these things. This is why education is so important. And now it's all flashing back to me that you had mentioned John Holt before. This is why I think there's something so profound in the philosophy of unschooling that I want to merge with, you know, an approach that invests in public goods and
bring them together. Yeah.
Right, to bring them together. I cannot overstate just what a tremendous gift I think it was to have that trust from a young age, to be asked, well, what are you interested in? What do you care about? Hey, why you should be responsible for this, right? This is, you know, this is on you to a degree, to the degree that you can handle as a child. Obviously, you don't want to overburden someone. Thinking about ways that we can nurture that trust, and of course, people have to earn it, is really important. I mean, the last thing I'll say is, I I'm writing an essay on the far right attacks on education every level, and I watched a lecture that will probably become legendary by Christopher Rufo, who some of your listeners may know. He was largely behind the attacks on Harvard president Clinton Gay for plagiarism, but as also the person who has been pushing the idea of divisive concepts, which are, you know, anything to do with the fact that racism has long been and still is a part of American policy and life. He also was just named the trustee of New College in Florida.
Yep. Like,
he's a close ally of Governor Ron DeSantis. He's a bad guy.
Yep.
And what he says in this talk is, the talk is called Laying Siege to the Institutions. And he says, you know, left-wing folks and progressives have taken over our schools at every level. So what we need to do is lay siege to them, to destroy them. And he says public trust in all institutions in this country, government, journalism, and education, are at a low. And he says very clearly, we do not need to rebuild that trust. What we need to do is take advantage of it and destroy things and lay siege. And so that's the thing. Diminishing trust works in the grain of those folks who are manufacturing insecurity, inflaming resentments, creating engines of grievance.
It does not
work for us.
I'm aware of his role in the attacks on Gay and others, and his whole plagiarism you know, gotcha machine. But what's the end goal of destroying all that trust? Is it just to benefit the wealthy and to keep inequality? What's at the end of that essay, what comes after the siege?
I think that's a great question. So they are absolutely for free markets, in for free markets in part because what they do is validate the deeper sense that inequality is legitimate, right? And so this is also part of their, you know, contempt for anti-racism, their contempt for feminism, right? So they want to impose an order, you know, of, you know, white supremacist patriarchy. The man, you know, is the king of the household. And, you know, and it dovetails with their version of Christianity. So they're remaking, for example, New College in Florida in the image of Hillsdale College, which is a Christian college. Right?
I applied to New College. I ended up getting into Harvard, so I went to Harvard. But New College was about 3 or 4 years old at the time, and it was a college equivalent of what we've been describing in terms of unschooling, you know, that sort of thing. It was really it had an enormous appeal to me as a teenager, and now to see that it has become first the stalking horse, and now it's actually going to be a demonstration project of destroying this curiosity and replacing it with Hillsdale.
I was just going to say that's so interesting what you say, because it shows exactly what a threat that merging of what we're talking about, the sort of unschooling curious spirit with infrastructure and public funding, because New College is a public institution.
It wasn't I applied. That this thing, right? You know this, don't you? It started out as a private college. I grew up in Florida. When I saw that the Florida University system had adopted New College, I thought that was a real credit to the state of Florida.
Yeah.
But this is what it ended up doing 20 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but that's interesting, because it has kept that ethos, you know, liberal arts, boundary pushing ethos. And that's precisely why Ruffo and his cronies, you know, despise it so much. So I think there's lessons there. One of the lessons is these folks are really serious.
Yeah.
They're really, mean-spirited. They want to drag us kicking and screaming back into the past, and they're very well funded and they're very energetic, and that's why we need to take very seriously the project of building solidarity at every level from wherever we happen to sit.
Absolutely. We're just about at the end. I wanted to do two things. Soon after the 2016 election, very soon, I discovered a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince, and it really struck me and has stayed with me, which was, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And I think that's a great deal. I mean, it's poetic and it's flowery, but I think it's a great deal of what we're talking about here, is that if people can have a vision of, you know, of a future that's more exciting than the past that they're yearning for, that's a big shift that I think has to happen in this country. And I'm going to throw you the last question, coming off of that, which is that you have said that your horizon is better problems. And it's interesting that we're talking about a ship and a horizon, but I was struck by that. One, that you chose the word horizon rather than goal, vision, mission, and so on. And what you mean, and I'll give you, this will be your last word. What do you mean when you say that you joke that your horizon is better problems?
I do like the word horizon, and why? Because the horizon is something you never reach. You know, you're always stepping towards it, but there's always a new horizon, right? So again, this goes against the idea that we've got it all figured out, that our blueprints are going to be the final blueprints, that we just need people to hew to our vision precisely, and then, you know, we will finally reach the end of history and we can all take a rest. That's just not how it works. You know, But I think this idea of better problems is a good one. Today, we live in a world where we are forced to ask and re-ask not just banal, but very cruel questions. Should trans people have the right to exist? Should women have the same rights as men? Should billionaires have the ability to extract fossil fuels and destroy the planet? You know, should healthcare insurers be able to undermine public healthcare, even if that means that people die? Those are questions that I think we can answer pretty easily, right? The answer to most of them is no, that's awful. The sticky part is, well, how do we build the power and the strategy to actually change things? Should we ever do that and we actually manage to create more egalitarian social relations and to address the climate catastrophe, well, then we're going to actually have a lot of really interesting problems on our hands, which is, you know, how do we actually govern ourselves? You know, where do we draw the boundaries of our community? Wow, we're thinking about ecosystems in a new way. Like, how should we relate to non-human life, to plants and animals? How should we prepare for the future and take into account the interests of people who aren't yet born, right? How do we create a democracy that actually make space for people who don't exist today? These are really neat, interesting problems that are just off the table at the moment. And I think we have to fight to put them on the table. And so the work of democracy will never be done. I end the book on democracy with the image of being perennial midwives, right? So I don't want to be a founding father who just, you know, puts down the rules of the new order, writes the Constitution, and then expects everybody to live by it. Rather, I think we need to perpetually and perennially kind of, you know, rebirth democracy to try to inspire the next generations to think for themselves, to tackle the problems of their day. And hopefully, again, their problems will be better than the problems that we're facing.
Yeah.
Or at least more interesting.
I think I'm more more sympathetic toward the founders than you are. Because when I read, and I'll say why, when I read them, I see them saying, of course we put this together in a hot summer in Philadelphia. Of course you folks will be wise enough to improve it, as almost every other democracy that has written the Constitution since ours, no one has duplicated ours. They have all improved it. And I think what they would have been surprised at was that the generations to follow them didn't have the adventurous, you know, improvisational view of things that they did. I think they didn't realize they were bequeathing this thing to some people who would venerate them, who would institute freedom of religion and then treat the founders like religious, you know, like a religion, if you follow me.
Yeah, well, I agree. I actually think that's true. And the idea of originalism is a kind of made up doctrine,
yes, right,
that has a political agenda. So I'm with you.
Okay.
You know, and I think my line is, you know, against the kind of stereotypical,
yes,
and sort of reactionary view of the founders.
That's right.
In the Constitution, you know, and a little dig at the patriarchy there.
Yes.
But absolutely, you know, to honor them, perhaps.
Yes, yes.
Means,
by continually
to challenge
reinventing,
them,
which is what they did.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, this has been great. Again, the new books are The Age of Insecurity and her latest, co-authored with Leah Hunt Hendricks, Solidarity, The Past, Present, and Future of a World-Changing Idea. The websites are Hidden Driver, Hidden, H-I-D-D-E-N, hiddendriveroneword.com, and debtcollective.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, oneword.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement, newsletter, telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and links to probably 10 or 15 articles to flesh out the conversation, email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum Podcast on Apple Podcasts and most of those podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production and George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices. And most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Astra Taylor, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for having me. Let's do it in another 4 or 5 years.
Exactly. Okay.
We'll see what's happening then, won't we?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks so much.